LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole. I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with you. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter. Driving mad. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window, or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. That you are a slave. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Right now, we're inside a computer program.
Is it really so hard to believe? Your appearance now is what we call residual self-image. It is the mental projection of your digital self.
This isn't real.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
You have to see it for yourself. You have to see it for yourself. You have to see it for yourself.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Dr. Rory McSweeney, who joins us to discuss some of the ideas in his book, The Paradox of Lucid Dreaming, A Metaphysical Theory of Mind. In this freewheeling off-the-cuff chat, we explore creativity, philosophy, the rise of independent media and growing global interconnectedness, psychedelics and shamanism, the origins of life, the potential existence of meaning and purpose throughout the cosmos, and the fundamental nature of reality itself. Can something really be created from nothing? And if not, has something always existed? Perhaps the biggest question of all is not how, but why. In a second installment to be released shortly, we'll delve into the book in more detail, discussing lucid dreaming itself, the startling implications of quantum physics, and the potential for the future of humanity. Hello and welcome, Rory, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure. It's a real honor. And I am joining a list of really fabulous speakers. So it's been, as I said, a real honor, and certainly an honor just to be on Rutger's Hoof.
Oh, thank you very much, Rory. And this is a follow-up in some ways, a little bit delayed to when I appeared
at wakeupinyourdreams.com when you host your podcast there, and there'll be a link to our conversation on the interview page for this chat. So people want to go and explore that, I think they should. Today we're going to be talking about your just released first book, actually, The Paradox of Lucid Dreaming, A Metaphysical Theory of Mind. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and work in general.
Sure. So I will start somewhere around my 10 years old, which is when I got involved in martial arts. That would have been probably my first step into personal exploration. I suppose to assume the role of the proverbial athlete as defined by Carl Jung's stages of development, it was my obsession with my body physique, or perhaps the physique of the opposite sex, more like at that point. But physicality obviously was the first chapter in this journey of self-exploration, hence martial arts was my first port of call, so to speak. So I spent a long time studying various types of martial arts, ultimately going into sports, competing internationally, and eventually kind of realizing the futility of that in terms of what it was I was trying to find. Then I managed somewhere prior to my kind of conclusion of my sports career to pick up a professional career, which I became a dentist. Although it may seem perhaps a little innocuous in regard to personal exploration, it gives me a grounding in biology and surgery and just science in general. So that certainly was a building block that I didn't see being important in the kind of personal architecture of my mind as things developed. I think ultimately things really started to become a little more colorful when in my 30s, I got a little more involved with more peripheral ideas. I say peripheral to normal society, specifically looking at ways to alter my mind. Specifically looking at traditional magic. I actually looked at, as it happens, sleight of hand magic for a while too, whatever the hell that was all about. Psychology, parapsychology, really anything that would alter my consciousness to any degree I was curious about. And that's kind of when I came across lucid dreaming. And lucid dreaming to me at that point, although perhaps not so much in hindsight, was very much the ticket to ride. When I first came across the idea of lucid dreaming, that one could assume the same degree of insight or thereabouts as we ordinarily have in waking consciousness during a dream state, to me that was the ultimate expression of magic. And that's very much where I turned my focus, was into lucid dreaming. And so for the last probably 10 years at this stage, realistically, I've been kind of practicing, modeling, and trying to kind of create some sort of an abstraction of the nature of our world from the dream state in relation to the waking state, and ultimately trying to build some sort of a metaphysical essay around that, which is ultimately what the book was very much. It was my, I won't say my conclusion, that would imply that the journey is finished or something. I think since the book's been written, I've had a lot of thoughts about it since, but I think everything that I wanted to say, I got to say in the book at some level. And I still think it, you know, even as an author, when you finish something, you don't expect it to hold as much water subsequently. There's this fear that as soon as you release the book, there's half that you want to change and half that you want to contradict and pieces that you don't necessarily agree with subsequently. But I think, you know, it's held water since, and I look at it in terms of how I see the world today, and I think the meta-philosophy is in there. So very much this book is the proverbial model of reality as I have understood it from having spent a lot of time in the lucid dream world.
Well, in the book, coincidentally, you mentioned the rock band Guns N' Roses, and as a writer myself, I'm more of a fire and forget guy. You know, if you fuck about like Guns N' Roses trying to do the your latest album, like Axl Rose spent so long, how many years was it? God knows.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's just release the bloody album, you know what I mean? So
Well, that's Zen, you see. I mean, my karate background teaches you the art of not thinking. In a karate bout, you've got 2 minutes and two half points, or if possible, if the point is accurate enough and powerful enough, you get one single point and that concludes the match. And in a karate bout, you don't have your opponent act. You contemplate what the reaction is and then you apply the appropriate technique. That's not how it works. They're simply act and react, act and react. And that's the essence of Zen, is to basically learn to stop thinking. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of writing a book, as you said, exactly, if you do the proverbial Axl Rose and you spend 10, 15 years out in the psychological wilderness trying to explore and understand yourself, and all you come up with is the Chinese whatever the fuck it was called.
Democracy.
That's what I... Have you been to see them play live recently in the last 10 years, perchance?
I saw them at the Leeds Festival, and listeners out there can Google that and find out when they played, but it was a really bad Guns N' Roses tribute. In fact, I've seen a Guns N' Roses tribute that was actually a lot better than Guns N' Roses are currently. You know.
The crazy thing, Axl sounds amazing. I've seen them twice in the last 10 years,
oh, really?
Both times in London. Yeah, and I mean, he is amazing, but, and there's a big but, there's this really awkwardness between him and the crowd where he ignores the crowd. And by the way, he completely ignores them. He spoke in one of the concerts, he spoke to the crowd once to say, ladies and gentlemen, Izzy Stradler. That was it. Nothing else for the whole night. I remember it so well. And in kind of, how would I say, perhaps in revolt or in reciprocation, when he plays his Chinese Democracy tracks, they all just stand still. It's horrible, and it's funny, and it's interesting. It's like this energy that comes alive. He opens up to You Could Be Mine, and the whole place just erupts. And by the way, he's late at this point, naturally, as you know. And then his voice is just, wow. And then he plays a Chinese Democracy song. Everybody sticks their hands in their pockets and has a conversation with each other.
That's interesting, because when I saw them, I say that time, Axl sounded rough as hell. I mean, like,
oh wow, yeah. Oh no, he can be amazing. Seriously, yeah. With respect. Yeah. Oh, seriously, he's. I used to work in the pop industry. I mean, you're around the music industry too yourself, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
25 years and counting.
Well, okay, right. Well, I've got a picture. I'm in my kind of art room here, and I've got a Smash Hits front cover in my room here for one of my bands that I had on the front cover of Smash Hits. And I've been to a lot of gigs. I've been to a lot of concerts, seen a lot of people play live. You know, can they play live as well? Can they record or whatever? Axl Rose, he's the best I've seen.
So you were in a band, were you?
Oh, managing, yeah, that was...
okay.
Yeah.
See, people listening to this now are finding out just this for the first time as I am. So, give me a couple of names then.
It's an Irish band called D-Side around the turn of the millennium, basically a boy band that I got involved with when I was very confused about my life. You know, I had all sorts of ideas about what it is I wanted to be. I just qualified as a dentist. I was on the international circuit in kickboxing. And I decided, you know, at that point, you are the proverbial king of the world. Mm. That would be, according to Carl Jung's four stages of life, to bring it up again, that would be the warrior stage. So at that point, I was the warrior and I wanted to conquer the world. Once more, the futility of all these things hadn't quite crept up on me yet. But it was interesting to do it. And it was successful to a degree. I mean, it was successful on paper. As I said, the paper being the cover of the magazine. But if you ask me in terms of the paper and my account, nothing. Pop music doesn't make squat. They didn't write the music. So if you don't write the music, you don't make anything.
Yeah, it's your difference between your publishing, which what you get for writing songs, and your mechanicals, as they call it, which you get for selling records, which is sort of like doesn't really happen anymore. So, and of course, if you're talking the turn of the millennium, that was around the time of Napster, wasn't it? And it was the whole business was changing.
I probably got in just south of that, to be honest with you. Yeah. But, you know, I remember subsequent to that act, having an act that could record and could write and had some very good tunes. But conversely and bizarrely, being a rock group, they couldn't perform. And I remember the conversation with my A&R at the time, who was a rather substantial A&R. And he had signed a lot of big acts, as well as my own boy band. And I remember him saying to me, you know what I'm going to say to you? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, they sound great, but they're not a good live act. And that's the way the industry is going. It's not going to be about, you know, selling, as you said, mechanicals. It's going to be ultimately about live performances and publishing to a degree as well. But when we realized that, I said, you got a great record, but you can't perform it. And that was the end of it. But now how do you make money in the music industry today? Fuck knows.
Merchandise, as far as I can see. It's one thing, you can't download a t-shirt, you know, it's like kids will actually shell out for merchandise.
They will, but record companies own that. They got like 360 deals now, so they own everything they sign. They sign your brand, they sign your body, man. They sign the whole thing away. If you sign a record deal today, you sign everything away.
I know. Actually, I had a record deal once and we held out on the merchandise. Because we, even then, and it's in the 90s, people were still buying records. We knew this was very important. And the record company were kind of like, we had three record companies that all wanted to sign us. So we're in quite a strong position. And the label we wanted to go with were like, kind of, well, obviously the merchandise is ours as well. And we're like, no, No. We keep that.
What were you? Were you playing? Presumably, what were you playing? Your guitar?
No, I was playing keyboards because they didn't need a guitar, so they needed a keyboard player. So I thought, right, I'm going to learn the keyboards really, really quickly.
Really?
Did it in about 3 months. I was
shit.
Oh man, it was. Talk about winging it. I could barely play, and I just said, yeah, okay, no problem, I'm in. You know. So
wow.
But that was an interesting experience. But we were looking at the figures, and if they had the merchandise, we were maybe going to get 8% or something of a sale, you know, whereas we struck a deal with the merchandise company directly, people who actually made the t-shirts, Razzmatazz actually they were. So Mike, if you're listening, hope to see you again one day. We ended up with about 80%. You know, because
that's a big difference.
Oh yeah, they understood that what they were doing was manufacturing the garments and distributing. You know what I mean? But the design, all the ideas were ours. So it ended up being very lucrative, and we ended up selling, even in the 90s when people were buying records, we sold 10 times as many t-shirts as we did CDs. Yeah. You know, so where I'm going with this is without that. Financially, we'd have been, you know, struggling, you know, whereas we actually all ended up able to make a living from selling t-shirts.
Well, that's the question, making a living today when you're a content provider. I mean, you know, you are a content provider here and you have a massive listenership here. I mean, I am a content provider. I certainly wouldn't have anything near your listenership, and I don't mean my podcast. I mean, just my audience in general, whether it's through Facebook, through my writing, through my blog, through just me standing in the room and you know, clapping my hands and shouting at the top of my voice and people turning around to listen to me. That's my audience, you know, wherever that happens to be. But the point is that, you know, converting that into something of a fiscal nature these days is becoming quite an exercise. You can have a lot of attention on your brand and not necessarily translate that to any kind of a financial opportunity. And that's a strange position to be in, because you've got like really, really intelligent, interesting people with some very creative output. And to be frank about it, they're doing it for free. And I include yourself there to a degree. I mean, you know, you're putting some very serious output out there to a very large audience. And ultimately, with the question we both got to ask is, how do we capitalize on that? Is that a question you want to get into?
Well, it's an eternal kind of question, really, you know, and it's something that I always have looked upon. It's a bit, an analogy here with making music, for example, or writing is quite opposite, because you do the work and don't think about the money. I can't remember where I first read it, but it was like, do the work and the money will show up type of thing. And sometimes that has worked, sometimes it hasn't. But as for, you know, it'll be interesting to see a year from now how many copies of your book you've sold, you know, what audience that has reached. And I'm reaching these enormous numbers of people. Now, when I say enormous, I mean by my standards, you know.
Oh, it's substantial, believe me. By anybody's standards, it's huge, believe me. It's big figures.
It's closing in on 100,000 a month. No, you know,
it's ridiculous, believe me. It's massive, huge figures, man. Yeah, you know, that has to translate something eventually. I don't know what the golden figure is before sponsors can step in and start to actually do something with it. But that's believe me, you've got enough momentum in your step right there. If you keep pushing that, it has to make sense. But I suppose to kind of bring it back on table, perhaps there's a different kind of a philosophical thrust to that, which is the nature of creativity, why we create, the teleology of creation. This is something I've been kind of wrestling with recently, as to, you know, what is the meaning of creation? You know, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there a universe in the first place? And if, you know, and there is a universe, of course, there is, it would seem to be some kind of a narrative in the universe towards a creative output, towards a kind of an escalation of complexity. There is an ingression of complexity in the system, and it doesn't seem to be incidental. Nature doesn't seem to be without a teleos. And I suppose that's a question I want to put back to you. Is that something that you see, that, you know, is the creative impulse something that you feel is inherent in nature? Is, you know, is that something you have a comment on?
It seems to be all that it's about, to be honest. That
right.
You know, that is the function, you know, that I can't buy into nihilistic ideas about there being no point in anything. Of course, we get this very much from our contemporary Western science. Well, I mean, probably everything since the so-called Enlightenment, I suppose, that, you know, nature is just a machine, and Darwinian survival of the fittest, rather. And this is all there is, and it's all one big accident with like no meaning whatsoever. And yet the only thing, the thing rather, that resonates most with us seems to be meaning. That's what people want. That's what's so frustrating about modern day science, or as I sometimes call it, scientism, is that the denial of meaning. You know, someone like Richard Dawkins, for example, not only does he deny his own subjective experience, but he denies the possibility of meaning.
And he does so with such emotion, it's ironic.
Oh, I know. It's like, so he's writing books telling us that we're that consciousness is a dream, or we're imagining it. Well, who's he writing the books for, you know, if that's the case, you know, so...
To be frank about it, I say that, you know, speaking of books, there were the two most important books ever written were the Bible and Origin of the Species. The former showing us the greatest magic trick the world had ever seen, and the latter showing us how the trick was done. And what's left is showmanship. And from that point of view, I see the world very much as a performance. You know, whether we adopt this weak-minded notion that somebody else created the world, or whether we take ownership for the world, or whether we decide to, you know, what I say by leaving something else to it, we can either adopt the position of some kind of an omnipotent being, if you want to be that tragic about it, or alternatively, you can resign it to something incidental and mechanical, which in itself doesn't answer anything anyway, because regardless of how the universe functions, that question, let me rephrase that idea doesn't tell us how the universe got the engine started in the first place. It answers a certain aspect of things, but it doesn't answer the bigger metaphysical questions. Now, I lean towards a more kind of Buddhist motif myself, which is ultimately that it's us, that we are the artist painting himself into creation, that it is us ultimately that are both responsible for the creation of this as well as the experience of this, and hence the creative impulse. Because ultimately, it's our own reality we're creating. And when we recognize that, it seems only natural that the very thing we want to do is to create. Richard Dawkins, whether he is, he can deny his subjective experience and his consciousness, but what he can't deny is his creativity. Creativity is what he does. He's creating content.
Well, I've touched upon this subject so many times with guests over the years, and you can understand why there is some resistance to some of the concepts that we're talking about here, because it gets bundled up with religion and God and all that sort of irrationality that floats around in that general area. So the idea of meaning and purpose and destiny or anything else, it all smacks of religion in some people's minds. Therefore, it must be resisted, because if you even open your mind to the possibility of meaning and purpose in the universe, then automatically, as you open the door, all these other lunatics come rushing in, you know, ISIS and, you know, the Paris attackers and, you know.
But I guess the question is, does creativity imply a particular meaning? Does it imply a particular teleos? I mean, can creativity be open-ended? It's a nice way of putting it, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's...
just impress myself at that
one.
Yeah,
we'll just leave it at that then, you know. So, thank you and good night.
I mean, I think it can though, right? I mean, you know, and I think that once we allow for that to take place, again, I'm not projecting creativity backwards towards how creativity gets, how it started in the first place. It's a different question. We can come at that with a different question. That's not the question I'm asking. I'm asking more so about just the process. Here, now, the cosmos as we see it, it's undergoing a kind of an exponential process of creativity. I mean, we're going through a technological revolution. Moore's Law, as I've quoted in my book, is making predictions about the world as we inhabit it that will be virtually unknowable in 1,000 years' time. It will be unknowable, if presuming we're still around. It seems like no coincidence that nature is experiencing this process, that it seems to be climbing towards something higher and towards, I'm not going to say towards a higher meaning. I'm not going to say towards some sort of a meta conclusion, as in Teilhard de Chardin and his, you know, omega point. I'm not alluding to that necessarily. I like the idea of creativity just being open-ended.
Yeah, I've often wondered about this, you know, in terms of the aforementioned meaning and purpose, as if there is some kind of plan, if you see what I mean, some kind of blueprint, as opposed to some kind of just feeling the universe, feeling its way in the dark. Just where is this going to go? Where is this going to go? Yeah.
Very good description. Yeah, I like that a lot. Well, I guess, so let's be brave, and then let's kind of pick up how this creativity might have begun in the first place. I mean, I have no doubt you've got your own view of this. I've certainly thought about it myself. Do you want to pick up that? I've got a little something to throw at you, but you want to go first with that one? As to, you know, why was this creative spark? Why in the first place? Why any of it? You know, I mean, as I say, if we can leave it open ended at the other end, and we can say the creativity, which I love your description, is feeling its way through the dark. But why in the first place? Why ever create anything in the first place? That implies a certain degree of meaning, perhaps, does it? And do you have anything for that?
Why is there something rather than nothing, I suppose, is the question.
The question, yes, yeah.
I did an interview with Jim Holt, a New York author, a couple of years ago, in his book Why Does the World Exist? And he went around interviewing a lot of philosophers about this. And the best thing I came away with from that was that the idea of there being nothing was absurd, because I said to him, well, nothing to me, I thought of like a vessel that was empty, but then there's still a vessel, if you see what I mean. So I just couldn't, after contemplating this for many years, decades probably, I couldn't conceive of nothing. So, and I've also recently, I don't know if I'm answering your question, actually, I'm just...
Oh, no, on the contrary, that's a very good answer. Yeah, keep going.
I've recently, probably in the last year or so, come to the idea that all the questioning that I was doing about origins and, you know, the infinite regress and stuff that we get into, which is actually can be quite unhelpful because you don't get anywhere with it, that there, the idea that there has always been something. And this seems to be an insult to our intellect in the, in certainly in the West anyway, because we have the theory of the Big Bang, which I don't think stands up at all, frankly. Speaking as a non-scientist, you know, but an interested layman. So the idea that there has always been something doesn't really address your question about creativity starting, but it's kind of an interesting philosophical kind of shift, if you see what I mean, to kind of ask different questions, maybe. I don't know if any of that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I think you've kind of come at it there. The idea of how can there be nothing? Perhaps consciousness has no model of nothing, and therefore can only... I mean, my book gets into this idea of how something contemplates nothing and how nothing gives meaning to something, and the two are polars. Their polarities as defined in Taoism. I mean, Taoism certainly takes on the challenge of this idea of something from nothing, as does Buddhism, really. In fact, that's really what Buddhism and Taoism are about, is that the motif of something from nothing is the core of their philosophy, really, whereby in Western science and in Western teleology philosophy, we're very much concerned with the idea of trying to fill that something with something. Whether it be meaning or whether it be some kind of a substance, we're trying to pour something into this void, try and fill it. But of course, the Taoists are telling us that the void is infinite and anything you pour in there just disappears into the infinity of all things. But I mean, from my point of view, having experienced myself in a state of pure consciousness, as is experienced in Zen practice sometimes, as is can be experienced a variety of other mind-altering techniques. My conclusion from that state was existential boredom. That I created this world because I was bored.
Oh, man. I've brought this point up before. Long-time listeners might remember me mentioning this, but now what the hell is the book called? Because it's it's co-authored by several people. And... I'm looking across the room here and it's on the shelf, but I can't find it. But in there, oh yeah, Inner Paths to Outer Space.
Okay.
And in one chapter of that book, the idea is presented that there is one consciousness, there is one being, whatever word you want to use. Mm-hmm. And it was so, maybe, I mean, I was so, or you were so appalled by your loneliness that you created all this nonsense so you could forget that you were alone, that there was only one being in any sort of existence. So I must dig that out again and get the form of words they use, because I'd love to be able to quote it.
Well, not to give the game away to the listeners, but, you know, if you get fucked up enough, That's what you find out. And that's what I found out on a number of occasions. And as a matter of fact, it even became so familiar when I got back there. I was there waiting for myself saying, oh, back here again, asking the same questions, are we? You know the answer, don't you? Now fuck off and forget.
Are you talking about psychedelics now?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Okay, well,
100%.
Yeah. I haven't taken ayahuasca, but I know you mentioned it. I didn't realize it was possible in this.
Ayahuasca doesn't tend to do it, actually.
Oh, okay.
Ayahuasca throws you a bit of a curveball. It's almost like you get to the gates of infinity and there's somebody waiting there for you. And that's the mother, the spirit, the ayahuasca, like the lady, mm-hmm. Mother Ayahuasca, if you want to call her that, people do. Is she real? Is she there? As real as you are in this conversation to me right now, she's there and she's real. And she does not offer you the creation myth of I created everything. That's not what you get from her. She's way more elusive. She assumes the role of some kind of a deity. And she's very sympathetic, very empathetic. And you role play the proverbial sinner who's come to cry at her feet and apologize for being an asshole. That's the experience you get with her. That's not where you get the experience of it's all one and I'm it and I remember everything and I remember why I created all of this and the Maya has, you know, effectively been, you've seen behind the trick. You become the proverbial, I mean, as I said, I studied sleight of hand for a few years and it's a very interesting reality you assume as a magician. And I mentioned this in my book to some extent, but I didn't get too much into it. It wasn't necessarily appropriate, but it's a very interesting role I play. When I perform magic for people, it's important that I recognize for the people who are looking at my magic tricks that what they're perceiving, if it's done correctly, really looks like magic. And they really have got nowhere else to go but, whoa, what the fuck was that? Did that? What, he must have done something with that. What? They have no, it's to them, it's ineffable. They have no way of languaging it into any kind of orthodoxy in their minds. But it's very important that I don't just go, oh, yeah, but it was just a trick, you know? Mm. No, I must make sure that I play along with it. And to some extent, this is what the Buddha tells us. Is that when we realize the nature of reality, that we both understand how the trick is done, but we also have to be aware of how other people are experiencing it. And we don't go around, you know, having this conversation, oh, by the way, so I took psychedelics and this is what I found out and this is what the world is really like and this is what's really going on. But at the same time, you know, people tune into your show, people read my book, people meet me at conferences and so on. And if you do get me down and dirty, if you do want to know where I'm coming from, that's certainly one model I will present to you. And I'm coming from a very sincere experience when I present that to you. It's not me trying to be flamboyant or trying to be facetious or trying to be a bit of a show off. It's really what I've experienced on a number of occasions. Is that what it is? It's possible. It's possible. But I've also experienced ayahuasca telling me, you know, you've been a naughty boy.
Yeah, it's quite the popular thing these days, isn't it? We hear about ayahuasca tourism. I actually had a friend of a friend who I've come to know over recent years, and he ended up spontaneously accepting an invitation to go to, I think it was Bolivia, can't remember offhand, but to do the ayahuasca experience in the jungle. And it was interesting talking to him when he came back, because he said that it didn't happen in the way that is often portrayed by advocates. You know, he says that he doesn't remember the experience. He said he just felt really bad. And the other people in the group that were there with him said that he got up in the middle of his ayahuasca trip and walked around, but he doesn't remember any of this. So, again, I don't really know where I'm going with this, other than just that's the only person other than yourself that I actually met, you know, talked about this experience firsthand.
Well, the first legal retreat is being opened in the US and in North America at the moment.
So did you have this experience in the UK here?
Yeah, well, well, yes is the simple answer. Yeah, I mean, I was going to be, I'd rather not say, but I mean, who's to say what exactly? Yeah, here in the UK, yeah, on a number of occasions, yeah, yeah. It's very good in the UK. You know, it's a bit like people practicing martial arts. People think that if you want to learn real, authentic kung fu, you must go to China. But if you watch the Ultimate Fighting Championship, UFC, of which I'm a big fan, of course, then the best martial artists are in North America and Brazil. And actually, you know, the UK's got some good fighters, or France or Germany, you know, or whatever. But believe me, you don't see many of the Japanese guys. Mm. They're just not that good. As it happens, shamanism doesn't have to be in the rainforest. You know, it's okay. We understand that we can take these ideas and we can assimilate them and we can readdress them and we can do all sorts of things with them. And that's what the world is going to look like in the future. It's not going to be about authentic shamanism. It's going to be about neo-shamanism. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be very important that we, by all means, take whatever technology we can from these people and we use their technology in the right way. I mean, for example, in martial arts at the moment, when the whole UFC, cage fighting, whatever you want to call it, you know, when that first came on board, it was a lot of wrestling and boxing and kickboxing was working. But traditional martial artists are creeping back into it now. We're seeing a lot more capoeira and karate and kung fu styles and so on creeping back in again. So it's not that these things are irrelevant necessarily. It's just that we need to kind of learn to work with each other, just to play with each other's ideas. So if somebody is going to do ayahuasca, for example, the UK's got some great retreats, no question. You don't need to be spending your big tourist buck.
I might have to look into that, actually. But go ahead.
I just wrote a piece in Psychedelic Press, which is out at the moment, and it was about me having a trip in a lucid dream, which I've had on one occasion. So if anybody, you know, wants to be cheap about their trips, there's a free trip there for you.
Do you know of the gothic rock band Fields of the Nephilim?
Shit, man, no, I don't.
You don't? Okay, that's fine. Get with the program, man. Anyway, I interviewed, maybe if you check out some of their music that you might understand it, I interviewed their frontman, Carl McCoy, probably about a decade ago. Very interesting guy, and they're into a lot of, as the name of the band might imply, a lot of esoteric subjects. And I have been to see the band play live, and it was like from the soles of my feet to the top of my head, goosebumps. I felt like I was actually being lifted off the ground by the music. And I talked to him about it, and the reason I'm saying this is he said it's modern shamanism. If you see what I mean.
That's really awesome. Of course I do. Absolutely. I mean, music is one of the most important tools the shaman has. And the future is going to be very bizarre. That's for sure. I mean, you know, marijuana is being legalized left, right and center in the world at the moment. That is just the thin end of the wedge for the psychedelics to creep in. They'll come in initially through kind of therapeutic use, and eventually they'll start to come in for more creative purposes and so on. It is what McKenna and Leary had visualized, a psychedelic future. You know, the world, and fuse that kind of psychedelia with, you know, good laboratory science, with proper modern philosophical concern, and with technology, and the future is going to be extremely bizarre. I mean, like it is, as I said, you know, to look from where we're standing and to try to visualize the future has now become an impossibility.
Are you familiar with the work of Rick Strassman?
Yeah, of course.
So I just wanted to check. I figured you might be, but I've had him on here, and
I've listened to you. Yeah,
that was interesting, but it was very his work. I enjoyed both his books, and particularly the most recent one, where he gets into more, you know, metaphysical speculation. But it was quite dry reading, particularly his first book, in the sense that he was very clinical and scientific. Well,
extremely.
You know, he's a doctor, and of course. Sure. And he was trying to process what these people were experiencing. And I think that the point I'm making is how many of those people were actually really changed after their DMT experience, you know?
Yeah, well, DMT is a curious one, because DMT is like, it's almost like watching the trailer for the movie, but never actually seeing the movie, if you follow what I'm saying. And, you know, it certainly is like bizarre. And it certainly would shake up your ontological foundations, in that whatever model you have of reality will certainly be rocked with the experience. But to say that it enters into anything as sophisticated is the prolonged experience that you get with the psilocybin or with the peyote or whatnot, where you enter into these virtual dialogues with other entities and they explain things to you. You can question them. They offer advice. They give you teachings. The DMT smoked in that way, or it was intravenous in the spirit molecule, of course. But it's a short, sharp burst. It was like, you know, 10, 15 minutes tops. And in that period, they weren't getting the, as I said, the interactive dialogue that you get with the other experiences. And that dialogue really is where the proverbial teaching is given. And the teaching one gets, hence the name teacher planter in theogens, as they're called these days, you know, it is literally a teaching. And that's a very curious thing, because I suppose the question therefore has to be, who's giving the teaching?
Well, this is it. This is what has had me spellbound to this day with my LSD experiences, which I haven't repeated in 20 years. But trying to tell people about it is kind of like, this cannot be done. But suffice to say, it changed my life, if you see what I mean. It's the understanding that, the way I like to put it, is that when it got to the peak experience, it was like, okay, I get it. The carpet, the curtains, the cat, the TV, it's all the same stuff. You see what I mean? And this, of course, overlaps then with quantum physics, doesn't it? And our understanding of the deep nature of reality. But it is literally the door's perception, isn't it? You know, you cannot go back. You cannot go back.
That's the point. I mean, that's you know, I like how Terence McKenna used to talk about the kind of more traditionally spiritually inclined folk, as people like to think about it. Of course, it's not. It's just, again, just a pseudo-moralistic you know, point of view, that in the classically Eastern tradition, you have to kind of, as McKenna says, the guru is there saying, come on, you know, you got to push, you got to push, you got to push the meditation, you got to sit there for hours, you got to push. He says, with the psychedelic, it's the exact opposite. You're like, fuck, slow this thing down. It's, you know, it's spiritual enlightenment by nuclear arm. This thing just explodes in your mind and just disrupts all your patterns, all your ideas. I mean, you can have, and Alan Watts used to talk about that quite comically, how, you know, there's nothing to it. Well, I mean, mind you, for that matter, and Alan Watts would talk about enlightenment a lot, saying there's nothing to it. It's not that big a deal. The nature of reality, you know, all these questions, if you want, you can play the game of I don't know what it is, and you can chase your tail if you like. Or if you want, you can get it. It's actually quite simple. And therefore, you know, if taking an LSD or I'm not sure ayahuasca, she's a bit more elusive, like I said. But the shrooms, they'll give you the answer if you take enough of them. But the problem is, you know, they're they're hard work. They're tricky.
Yeah, I found the best way was to put them into a curry. Just something really, really powerful flavor. So it would... it would mask the fact that they tasted so disgusting.
Well, I mean, there are many tried and tested recipes. I'm not sure any are successful when it comes to taste. But certainly, if you want to pack the proverbial punch, you know, I think you have to subscribe to Terence's recipe, which is 5 dried grams. And that is the proverbial heroic dose. And if one is brave enough to consume that quantity and sit, as Terence prescribes, in a silent, dark room with the phone unplugged and the internet switched off, you know, then one will be shown the true nature of all things. And it's a funny thing, because I like McKenna, and I equally like Alan Watts. I think they're two incredible speakers, but they both play the game of what is it very differently. Mm-hmm. It's like Alan Watts is there saying, I'll tell you what it is, but you have to make a deal with me. You have to promise to just get it, because I'm telling you what it is. Did you get it? No. Okay, watch this. I'm going to tell you what it is, but you have to get it. Did you get it? No? Oh, let's try again. So he's the Zen master, and he's constantly erupting into laughter because he thinks it's so fucking funny that you're here like, wide-eyed and horrified at your existence, and you have to, you know, come here to listen to this guru. He's laughing. He's saying, did you not get it? Right? But Terence, on the other hand, who, considering how much he's taken. Mind you, actually, his brother Dennis said he didn't take that much. As it happens, I read Dennis's autobiography recently, and I actually interviewed Dennis on stage recently. And I had to kind of do some research about him and his relationship with his brother. But he seemed to think that Terrence didn't do as much psychedelics as people think he did. But whether or not he did a lot of psychedelics is perhaps not the question. He certainly did a lot of thinking about psychedelics, that's for sure. And you don't need to do a lot of psychedelics necessarily if you can just have enough experience to, as you said, with LSD, one experience, maybe it was two, I don't know, whatever number of experiences you had, 20 years later, they're just as relevant. Mm-hmm. Because that's just how powerful the experience is. Well, from that point of view, Terrence is, I always think of Terrence as being like the ringmaster. And he's like, well, come and watch the show. What is it? Oh, well, it could be this. It could be that. And let's just play with it. So he takes you on a wild ride. I mean, I can listen to a Terrence McKenna lecture and come out more confused than I could have been if had, you know, he absolutely flips your mind like a skateboard. And then Alan Watts is the exact opposite. He once said that an excellent Zen, and I'm paraphrasing here, an excellent Zen exposition leaves the mind untangled from its thoughts. It's more like an open window than a stained glass, whereby Terrence does the exact opposite. He stains the glass for you.
I like Alan Watts a lot, and it gets a bit of, even all these years after his death, he gets a bit of flack in some circles for kind of just, you know, appropriating Eastern philosophy or whatever. But I mean, he's, as you say, a great speaker, and he brought a lot of those ideas for the first time to the West. And it's got a great little book. What the hell is it called? I read it a couple of years ago. Something about the myth of being you or something. I can't remember.
It's basically about the kind of taboo of knowing who you really are.
That's it. Well remembered.
And actually, this is kind of where we got to the start of the conversation. I was talking about existential boredom and whatnot. And I felt like, I mean, is this appropriate to get into this at this stage? I mean, this is very much more where we should be kind of taking this perhaps in a later talk or whatever. But I just, you know, if it comes out, it comes out. And this is the thing, you see. You know, I remember hearing Terrence McKenna once, and he was on a talk, and it was towards the end of his life, actually. He was kind of asked, you know, so what's it all about? Why do you do what you do? And what do you want from all this? Was the question, I think. This is what I expected. I thought he was going to turn around and just absolutely pour out some incredibly, like, just sci-fi-esque narrative about machine elves and DMT hyperspace and the origins of language and how all that was going to culminate into some sort of a transcendental spaceship that was going to float out of his brain at the moment of his own death. And this is what he said instead. I was horrified at the time. He turns around and he's kind of, well, you know, well, peace. Now, that's what everybody wants. I want peace. And I was like, what? Fuck. That was a bit like your favorite rock act coming out and playing Hit Me Baby One More Time. I was like, what the? What? But it was only years later that I got it. And I know more about him as a person and his own inner demons and his frank depression, for that matter, and how, you know, how his own life. I mean, it was Krishnamurti said, you know, your life is your life is your work. I know your life is your
greatest art or something like that.
Yeah, and he goes, no. My life is a mess. My work is my work, or something to that effect. And it was a lovely statement. Mm. But in no uncertain terms, they were the words of a man who was hurting on the inside. And I think probably not at that moment, but certainly the seed of change had been set in my mind when I heard that. And it was around the same time I'd found Alan Watts. And it was around the same time, too, that I had come to my own kind of deep understanding of things. And ultimately, and this is going to sound perhaps very boring to a lot of your listeners, but the thing you're trying to discover really is that it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. What do you want from all this? You can go to the circus, and the proverbial Terrence McKenna will be there in some form or shape, saying, "Here are the three rings. these are the dancing ladies, this is the elephant that balances on one toe, and here are the vile tigers over here, and we're going to put you through all sorts of performances with them, and it's going to be wonderful. As a matter of fact, Rick Strassman talks about the circus a lot in The Spirit Molecule, mm-hmm. and it was a strange metaphor that he didn't quite get his head around. And that's one thing that the DMT can do, or that's one thing the psychedelic can do. It can show you that all of this is just virtually impossible to understand, and it's just infinite galaxies and just swirling stars and so on. And reality is that, absolutely. It's perhaps infinite. It may be this proverbial cosmic merry-go-round that has no beginning, has no ending, and can show you absolutely anything your mind can conceive. Yes, it's all those things. But at its essence, at its very core, because it's all of those things, it's therefore none of those things. Because all of those things together imply nothing. Because they have no inherent meaning unto themselves, other than the meaning they imply to each other. They're all relative to each other. And that's really the thing that you're trying to get your head around. My book does get into this, in all fairness. It's quite a Zen book in its own way. I mean, it's relatively short and small in some ways. And what I'm trying to deliver, the message I'm trying to transmit to people, is to stop with all the questions, stop with all the philosophical architecture and mathematical models you're building. All those things are fabulous if you want to create more technology and have more versatile experiences. And this is the open end of creativity that we spoke about at the start of the show. And I'm all for that. And I think that should go on infinitely, indefinitely. And it will do, because it's doing itself. There's nobody doing that necessarily. But at its core, at its essence, this whole question of why in the first place, or why any of it, why, it doesn't really matter.
I know.
It just is.
I don't want to get all Eckhart Tolle on your ass here, but, you know, you sort of look at a tree, or you look at a cow in a field, sort of, you know, chewing a bit of grass or whatever, and you're thinking, what is it with us that we're so beside ourselves with questions and doubts about, you know, and we seem to be alone in that respect?
Well, that's what Buddhism asks. Mm. Buddhism asks the question, you know, religion, Catholicism talks about the fall of man. Terence McKenna talks about the fall of man. Alan Watts talks about the fall of man. I'm referring to Terence and Alan. I could be talking about Eckhart Tolle, or I could be talking about Kant, or Schopenhauer. It doesn't matter. We're all fundamentally asking the same questions. I use them because they're goalposts that I tend to play into quite frequently. So I'm just speaking from familiarity, but please feel free to substitute them with anybody else. I don't want to persuade people that anybody that I have listened to this guru and I think like him, or I've listened to that guru, I think like him. I think like a guy who took a lot of mushrooms, and that's who I think like. 50% of what I understand the world to be is modeled on what I have learned from other people, and 50% has been completely fabricated from my own understanding. I can't say it's 50-50 exactly, but that's how I like to see the world. I'm a classic self-experimenter, as I mentioned in the book. I very much advocate self-experimentation, and I think all Buddhism ultimately is about meditation, is about self-experimentation, it's about self-inquiry. Buddhism is about self-inquiry. I've kind of lost my train of thought now.
So that's why we're recording this, because we can edit and move things around. So you could, if you want to.
Fuck the edit, man. No, fuck. I always just freestyle it. Don't edit it. And even what I just said right there, fuck the edit.
Okay. Well, I do just some edits, but people are going to hear this and it won't be edited. So there you go.
Fuck no, man. Don't edit. Never, never, never. You don't edit life. Why should you edit your recording? Well, different people, yes. Don't edit me. No, I'm fucking straight talking. But I guess I was just asking that question about the fall of man, and why it is, as you said, we're so beside ourselves. And it's a really important question. And the reason we're beside ourselves is very simple, because we have the ability to self-reflect. It's as simple as that. And that is, to quote, and I saw you putting this on Facebook, which I think is a fabulous film, by the way. I saw you putting Marilyn on Facebook from John Boorman's Excalibur, yes. Which is a extraordinary film by all means, but there are some fine quotes in that film, and it was a line when K. King Arthur meets Sir Lancelot at the bridge for the first time. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm paraphrasing. And he says to him, who is it who is this man who claims that he cannot be killed by king nor man? And he said, who makes this claim? Or who is man who says this is who says this is his gift? And he says, 'tis not a gift, my king, but a curse. Mm-hmm. And it's this great idea that the thing that makes us so incredible is the very thing that makes us so fucking impoverished. Because ultimately, the reason you and I can have this conversation in the way that we are across the airwaves, we are literally having a conversation across the air, whatever the fuck that is.
Yeah, what is our conversation made of? Is it like
the fact that we can ask that question is exactly the point. There's nothing else that has the abstract intelligence to ask the question, what is this conversation? There's no other species that we know of that can ask that question in that way. Animals can speak, for sure, but they can speak monkey see, monkey do. We can ask monkey see, monkey do, monkey ask why. And that's the difference with us. And if you want to ask why, you need to have something very unique, and that's self-reflective awareness. And that's really where the kind of linchpin of my thinking comes from. You certainly very much in the book, you'll see that's where I'm talking. I model my whole kind of theory based on self-reflective mechanism. And when you have self-reflective awareness, you have what I describe as a double-edged sword. And what I mean by that, plain and simple, is on the one hand, you have the ability to create technology. You have got the creative joker in the pack. You can create anything once you have the language to be able to speak to yourself in your own mind. But on the other hand, you also have the sense of your own fatality, of your own ultimate death. I presume you've seen the film Crawl.
Yes, not for some time, but yes.
I'm surprised. Yeah, it's a classic, as no doubt you'll remember. But there's a great character in it, and it's the Cyclops. And the Cyclops basically was fooled by the gods. They traded in their two eyes for one eye to see into the future, but the gods tricked them. This is the story from the film. And the trick was that they can see into the future, but all they can see is the time of their own death. And if they don't accept that time, then their death's going to be very painful. But of course, the Cyclops comes back in the end, even though he actually walked away for his own death and so on. Fabulous film. But it was a great little moral tale that we humans have asked for, whether we asked for it, whether it evolved, whether it's somehow inherently there. We have this self-reflective awareness. And it's as if we have the same problem as the Cyclops. We can see into our future, and we can make predictions, and we can make calculations. We can see into our past, and we can extrapolate patterns and make models from that, which we can use to make predictions about the future, and we can create things because of that. But the difference being that my cat, or my cats for that matter, if I was to make a loud noise, they run away. So they have some sense of self. They have some sense of self-preservation. But if I sat down and said to my cat, as I do occasionally, one day you're going to die. And when you die, I'll be there to look after you, because I know you're going to die, but you don't know it. And it's a very sad feeling that I have about it, because I love my cats. And, one of my cats particularly comes to bed every night, and he sits on my chest and we have a little conversation. And I know that one day he's going to be an old cat and I'm going to see him die. And I have all that emotional baggage around that cat, but he doesn't have that around his own death. And that's the difference. So that's where we stand. We stand as these self-conscious beings that have become aware of the nature of our existence. And because of that, we are both creative, but we are also destined to dukkha, as the Buddha calls it, which is suffering. And that suffering ultimately stems from the notion that one day we are going to die. And everything dying around us, even this conversation that will eventually die, is ultimately an expression of that death. They are proverbial petits morts. They're small deaths. They're happening everywhere in our lives. We're always losing things. We're losing our friends, our food, even a can of Coke. Everything is just dying and dying and dying. And we get into this place of trying to hold on to that. We try to protect it. because we think that somehow if we really, 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 really think about this thing, if we really work hard and if we think a hell of a lot, we'll somehow think our way out of our situation. And that's how we get addicted to thought. And that is the epidemic that is rife in human consciousness. We become addicted to thinking. And that addiction to thinking is ultimately the source of our suffering. So really, we've got to try to learn to stop thinking.
A very early memory I have is, I don't know what age I would have been. I remember where I was at the time. It was by the coast in Ireland. And this is probably irrelevant observation about what was actually happening at the time, but my grandfather's brother was a missionary in Uruguay, and he'd come back for a visit, and I was stood in the driveway of my grandparents' house. I don't know, was I washing the car, or was I just sitting in the car turning the lights on and off and peeping the horn as I used to like to do? And this guy came walking up the drive, and I remember him speaking, but I couldn't hear his voice, just his lips moving. And in my mind, I was saying, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this? And by that, I meant reality. It was like I'd woken up in the Matrix or something. You know, I was like saying, what's wrong with this? So the reason I mention this is because what you just described or alluded to, is there something wrong, or is this a step in evolution, if you want to use that word, development, whatever it is, this creativity? Is it just a signpost along the way, you know, or have we gone down some terrible cul-de-sac? I don't know.
Well, McKenna talked about the current, that self-conscious awareness was a kind of a neurosis of nature. Mm. That history itself, which ultimately was born out of self-reflective awareness, was a wrong turn made by nature. I personally don't subscribe to that. Buddhism would be more inclined to tell you that ultimately anything that we perceive to not be self-aware, remember, you can't help but get a little bit more anthropocentric around this idea. The world you know ultimately is only ever from the point of view of a self-reflective being. You have the philosophical problem of other people's minds to consider. You know, whether or not they have minds, we don't know. That is the technical term in philosophy, the problem of other people's minds. You know, these are tricky questions to get into. But from my 10 cents, it is ultimately, if we take this back to its roots, the cosmos itself that is self-reflectively aware, and it becomes from its essence of pure awareness and its infinite awareness, perhaps this state of being that one experiences in meditation, perhaps to some degree, I can't say from personal experience, certainly with psychedelics, where we have this ultimate awareness, and it's an awareness beyond things, beyond phenomena. It's an awareness that allows those things but doesn't attach to those things. It recognizes those things but doesn't perceive the world as those things necessarily. This is why they call it transcendental. This is why the mystical experience can't necessarily be translated into anything simple. We don't necessarily have a language to hold it together. But there is that sense of eternal understanding, awareness, being, presence that I am, that you are, that when I say I mean I, the bigger I, that is just what is. And it always is. And the only question it asks is not, what am I? Because what I am, of course, is infinite. But the question it asks is, what can I be? How can I experience myself? And ultimately, that is what causes the Big Bang into effect, if you want to kind of look at that creation myth. And again, this is just a narrative we're employing. We're not saying there was a Big Bang per se, more like a small pop anyway. And besides, who heard it? if you want to go there.
Is the fridge light really on, sort of thing, you know, when you close the door? Does it really go off?
Well, you know, the thing is that ultimately if what we are is pure experience, and again, in the same way that I allow creativity to be open-ended, I allow experience to be open-ended. What can be experienced? What can be created? They're the same question in many ways, and it's open-ended. But ultimately, it would only seem necessary for self-reflective awareness to come into being at some point. Otherwise, the exercise would be futile. If, for example, you have a normal dream, okay? In a normal dream, you're not what we would call particularly self-reflectively aware. And coincidentally, creative as that dream was, you don't remember any of it. So it would seem, in order to have a memory, to gain context from that memory, and therefore to color your future experiences from the context of the previous experiences, it is necessary to be self-reflective aware. Because as I said, if we look at a normal dream, as opposed to a lucid dream, one you remember, one you don't. And the difference being your state of awareness. In the same way, you might remember what you did yesterday, but you won't remember what you dreamed last night. And the difference being you haven't got that self-reflective aware mechanism. So it would seem that we need that to create context in order to have more depth to our future experiences. And if we take that model and we project it on into a future, one would contemplate that we can build on these experiences, that we can resolve this self-reflective awareness into something more substantial, something more forgiving. And that's ultimately what Buddhism proposes, is not to abandon self-reflective awareness, not to, as some people think, this idea of becoming completely detached, that ultimately the self, the sense of I, the sense of you and me, the illusion of separation, as they call it, that we must somehow transcend that and recognize that it's all one. And you see the world as if you're constantly on an LSD trip. If somebody's selling you that, then they bought Buddhism 101, read the book and think they understand it, but they haven't experienced it. Buddhism isn't telling you to do that at all. Buddhism is telling you that when you wake up in this dream of life, as I open my first chapter of my book and talk about, when you wake up in the dream of life, nothing actually changes, except that everything changes. And it's a paradox. But the point I'm trying to make is that things still look and feel the exact same way. But the difference is, somewhere in your mind, you realize that all of these things that appear to be separate are really me. And this place that I call here is actually there. And what I thought was then is actually now. And that everything is happening in this eternal moment. And it's me. And it's always been me. And it'll always be me. And I don't mean me, the physical body that I'm assuming right now, but the eternal awareness that holds it all together. And that's really what we're trying to somehow come to understand in our own individual ways.
Well, Rory, we're going to pick this up again in the very near future and actually explore some of the ideas in your book more deeply, specifically about dreaming. One little thought I just want to share with you is that not that long ago I had a dream, and someone I know but who I haven't seen for 20 plus years appeared in my dream, and I said to them, what are you doing here? And they said, I have dreams as well. And it was kind of like, you know, you're not unique to this space, you know, we're all in here, you know. And it was it stuck with me, well, obviously ever since, you know. It was a very interesting experience.
As Alice said, curiouser and curiouser.
Oh, quite. Okay, Rory, before we leave off for today, just share with folks details of your website and, of course, wakeupinyourdreams.com. And today we've been talking about your book, which is widely available, The Paradox of Lucid Dreaming. And just anything else you'd like to put out there?
Yeah, the best place to catch me these days, cheap as it might be, is probably on Facebook, to be honest with you, because it does all the work for you. So you can friend me if you like. Preferably just pick me up on Reality Check Podcast there, or alternatively, I just put up a new page called Dream Warrior, which I think is kind of where I'm trying to point traffic at the moment. But that's the best place to catch me. I do come up on Twitter occasionally, so you can try and hit me up on that, but it's not something I'm a big fan of. So yeah, Facebook is probably the best place to get me, or by all means, just direct on the website, wakeupyourdreams.com. Or by all means, if you see me on the street, stop me, mug me, whatever.
Splendid. Well, Rory, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Pleasure, man.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.